Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Voices of Reform Project's annual post-election series. I'm Zabre Valentine, Director of Voices of Reform, and I want to thank you for joining us for a discussion of potential opportunities for bipartisan collaboration in the area of campaign finance reform. The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program will be moderated by John Myers. Mr. Myers is the Capital Bureau Chief for KQED and has spent the past 14 years as a reporter, anchor, and editor in both television and radio news. His previous work experience includes anchor and managing editor at KFBK News Radio in Sacramento and anchor political reporter for NBC affiliate KSBY-TV in San Luis Obispo. Mr. Myers' reporting work has been heard on National Public Radio and seen on MSNBC. In 2005, he received two awards for his political and policy reporting, the California Journalism Award for Radio Reporting and Best Radio Writing from the Northern California Radio and Television News Directors Association. His career highlights also include serving on the panel of journalists in the first statewide televised debate of the 2003 California recall election. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to John Myers, who will introduce our panelists and moderate today's discussion.
Thank you, Sabre, and no reporter could ever live up to that intro, so thank you very much. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for allowing me to sit in on this discussion. As a political reporter, these are often the folks I rely on to help understand this complex issue, and it's a fascinating issue, I think. Just a brief overview of some of the thoughts on campaign finance reform. I was looking back in a poll from the Public Policy Institute of California last September. More than 60% of those surveyed agreed that campaign contributions hurt public policymaking in the Golden State. But time and again, campaign finance reform plans have somewhat stumbled, it seems like, in recent times, defeated at the polls, or if approved, struck down or modified by the courts, or largely figured out by political professionals, I should say, who often find the cracks or the loopholes that allow the money to flow in. The 2006 elections apparently now hold the record for spending on political campaigns, some $600 million total spent on statewide races, legislative races, and ballot measure campaigns. In fact, one attempt recently to add up the spending found some $247 million alone spent on television ads. It can be said that the modern era, of course, of campaign finance reform began with the passage of Prop 9 back in 1974, which, as we know, had a big hand in establishing the Fair Political Practices Commission. But I think we should fast forward probably to the broken somewhat track record, unfortunately, of recent proposals. We know in 1996 that voters said yes to Prop 208, the ballot initiative that imposed some pretty tight limits on contributions, but also gave candidates a chance for some looser limits if they abided by some overall spending limits. But in 1998, of course, the courts blocked Prop 208 after the political parties had objected. And in 2000, the legislature gave us Prop 34, which is kind of our current system that our panelists obviously will talk about, which dramatically increased the size of allowable contributions and, of course, did not set limits on donations to political parties, which some folks have wondered about. This fall, as we know, Prop 89 would have changed a lot of that. It was also a dramatically different proposal from the status quo, moving toward public financing of campaigns and imposing new limits on contributions to ballot measures and initiatives. But the voters said no, for reasons that I'm sure we will talk about later. And here we are back at this difficult but I think very important issue about the influence and the proper place of money in politics. So with all of that in mind, let me introduce today's panelists, our esteemed panel of panelists. First, we'll begin closest to me and moving down, Leanne Randolph. Leanne Randolph has served as chair of the Fair Political Practices Commission since March 2003. Her term expires on January 31st of this year. The days are ticking, apparently. Prior to her appointment to the FPPC, Ms. Randolph advised the city of San Leandro as a city attorney. She also served as city attorney for Sassoon City and advised other cities, including Petaluma, Healdsburg, and Sassoon City, on redevelopment matters. She was a staff attorney in the legal division of the FPPC from 1995 through 97, providing advice on conflict of interest issues to public officials and representing the commission in litigation on matters of campaign finance. She has also practiced election and campaign finance law and commercial litigation. We thank her for being here. To her left is Bill Leonard, elected to serve on the Board of Equalization in 2002 and was reelected in November 2006. Prior to that service, Mr. Leonard served in the state legislature for 24 years, first elected to the Assembly in 1978. In 1988, was elected to the state Senate, where he gained the distinction of being the longest-serving Republican caucus chairman in the Senate. In 1996, he returned to the state assembly, seeking the opportunity to serve in the majority there. At that time, Mr. Leonard was assembly Republican leader for the 1998 cycle. To his left is Mr. Tom Hiltak. Tom is a partner at Bell, McAndrews & Hiltak, LLP, which specializes in campaign, election, and administrative law and litigation at all levels of government. He has practiced political and election law exclusively since 1988. He has served as legal counsel and treasurer to statewide and local political action committees, ballot measure committees, trade associations, and candidates, and he currently serves as a legal counsel to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And last but certainly not least, Bob Stern, who is the president of the Center for Governmental Studies, and he has been since 2000. The center is a Los Angeles-based nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that creates innovative political and media solutions to help individuals participate more effectively in their communities and governments. Bob has been active in the political reform movement for over 35 years. He began drafting and analyzing political reform laws as a staff attorney for the California Legislature's Assembly Elections Committee, and then served as the Elections Counsel to California Secretary of State. He was the first general counsel of California's Fair Political Practices Commission and was the principal co-author of California's 1974 Political Reform Act and a principal drafter of the City of Los Angeles's ethics and public campaign finance laws approved by voters in 1990. So as you see, we have a very distinguished panel, and I'm going to rely on them to inform all of us about this issue. Let's jump in, if we could, right off. And as I was thinking about the issue, I was wondering if we could start briefly with a discussion about the reality of change in the campaign finance structure of California. You know, we all know that we have interest in doing things different. We also know the old saying that I kind of referred to earlier or alluded to about money in politics is kind of like water that finds its way around or through a crack in the rocks if it can find it. And so perhaps I'll start with Bob Stern. Just a brief assessment of the chances of changing the campaign finance structure in California these days.
Well, Happy New Year, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I want to start off by saying there are really two good things that California's laws have right now. We do have a very good disclosure law. In fact, California's campaign disclosure law has been ranked number one in the country. So that's a good thing. We also, and I won't, even though Leanne is here, I'll still say this, we have a very good Fair Political Practices Commission, and we have, it's the best state commission in the country regulating campaign financing, ethics, and lobbying. So those are two really good things about California that we should be proud of. But I think all the panel, I think, will agree on the statement I'm going to make, and that is it's unlikely, very unlikely, that the California legislature is going to change California's campaign finance laws this year or in the next couple of years, unless there's a major scandal, which we don't anticipate. But unless there's a major scandal or unless the California legislature decides to weaken the campaign finance laws. We're coming out with a report next week or so written by Steve Levin, who's in the audience. Steve, raise your hand. And it's called In the Dead of the Night, How Midnight Legislation Weakened California's Campaign Finance Laws and How to Strengthen Them. And this is all about Prop 34 and what happened with Prop 34 and how the legislature repealed Prop 208, which was going to come back into being because the Supreme Court had allowed lower contribution limits to exist, and how the legislature in 1 week basically repealed Prop 208 and put on some very weak campaign finance laws. So it's unlikely that the legislature is going to do anything. Later on, I can tell you what I think the legislature should do, but I'll stop with that.
Tom Hiltak?
I agree that I think in terms of disclosure, California is probably leading the way. I think there's some improvements that could be made in disclosure. I think it's very complicated. I think we could simplify the calendar. We could simplify the manner in which the forms work. I think with the progress of the internet, I think there's an opportunity to to redo forms and timetables and more frequency. And I think I could see bipartisan reform in that regard. There was a former Secretary of State McPherson had a commission to try to do some of that, and a report was issued. They actually didn't reach a consensus on that commission. But I think there was a lot of areas that there was consensus that I think could be moved as a bill where I think the legislature might go forward. And I think there's other areas that you might not consider campaign finance reform, but I think would reform the system and maybe lessen the need for money that could be discussed that I don't think is widely considered campaign finance reform, but I think something we should talk about.
Tom obviously sounds somewhat optimistic, it seems like, with some ideas. Bill Leonard, do you share that optimism?
Not at all. I mean, I'll argue and disagree with Bob. I think the system has failed. And agree with Bob that the disclosure is really the good part. I disagree a bit. I think we've so underfunded our FPPC that they're living off of past year's reputation and politician wants to get away. But I think you made the point. The incumbents have figured out how to game the system. And they got elected under that system. And it's kind of like the redistricting argument of the other panel. They're unlikely to vote against their own interests. They figured it out. Their opponents, some teacher working in a classroom, some businessman owning a store, haven't figured it out yet, and they haven't hired all their lawyers yet, and they're not likely to win any kind of election yet because of that. And so I don't think the legislature is inclined to change at all.
Leanne Randolph, you obviously have a front row seat to the current laws, and are on the way out, I guess, as chair of the FPPC, but I'm just curious what you see the road ahead as being.
Well, since I get to go last, I have the opportunity to actually agree with pretty much all of the panelists. I mean, I think Bob is correct that we have a great disclosure system. I think Tom is very correct that there are opportunities out there that the legislature could really take advantage of to make that disclosure easier and more accessible. Having a system, an internet system where it's easy for people to look and see not only what's being contributed kind of on the micro level in terms of, individual line items, but having reports, having some additional analysis. Years ago, the FPPC used to put out reports analyzing contributions and money flowing and where it was flowing and where it was flowing from. And there's a huge opportunity, I think, to fund additional ways to do that analysis and make that analysis available on the website so that people can access it. I also agree that there's not a lot of incentive to make changes in the legislature once people are elected and they're comfortable and they've hired their professionals and they've been through the system. And lastly, we always need more funding. We've been very fortunate under the current administration has been increasing funding over the last few years, and I hope that continues.
I'm wondering, and anyone can jump in on this. It seems like as a political reporter here, one of the things that I often hear in talking to people when we talk about campaign finance reform is some kind of balancing act or different ways of looking at it, I should say, between the issue of disclosure and the issue of limits. There are some people around here that say that what we really just need is full instantaneous disclosure. We don't need limits. We just need disclosure so we know where it's coming from. And there's another set of people that say, no, we really need limits. We need, and that's what a lot of campaign finance reform proposals have been based on. I'm wondering, any of you and hopefully all of you, where are your thoughts on that spectrum? I mean, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, of course, but there are some people who believe that really it's a disclosure problem and more than it is a excess of limits and donations. Anyone thoughts on that? Bob Stern?
We obviously need disclosure. I think we need much tougher limits than we have. The limits that we have, if Bill Leonard is running for governor, I can give him $23,000. If Bill Leonard is running for president of the United States, I can give him $2,100. There's something wrong there. Who's going to give Bill Leonard I'm sorry, Bill, I won't be giving you the $23,000. Who gives that amount of money? Only people who have something that they want, or maybe close friends of Bill's. But that's a limited category, probably, in terms of the money. 90% of the campaign money that comes in comes from people who want something from the person. And if you just have disclosure, that means that Chevron or Shell or the tobacco interests can give unlimited amounts of money to both sides in the campaign. So you have the disclosure, and Tom receives $10,000 from the tobacco company, and I receive $10,000 from the tobacco company. What's the voter going to do? Not vote, I guess. So I think that you have to have strict limits because the contributions are government access money. They are money that is given for governmental access reasons, not for election purposes, particularly with this redistricting situation we have now where nobody has very much competition. So we have to have stronger limits, and I think we have to have public financing. Now, obviously, Prop 89 went down badly, and so what I would be suggesting is an experiment with public financing with maybe one statewide officer, like, such as insurance commissioner, or maybe some open seats for legislators, and let's see if public financing can work in California.
Does everyone agree that limits need to be part of the equation somewhere? Tom Hiltak, you're shaking your
head
no,
not.
And then we'll
no,
move on.
Because I think limits have perverted the process. So instead of the public knowing that the tobacco industry supported Bill Leonard, what they don't know is that the tobacco industry, through a bunch of front groups with a bunch of other people interested in influencing the vote, have done an independent expenditure or express or issue advocacy or some other sort of form to try to influence voters without coming clean as to the fact that they're supporting Bill Leonard. And Bill Leonard is sitting on the sidelines, not even able to run his own campaign because of the millions of dollars that's coming into an assembly seat when the assembly candidate is dwarfed by the amount of independent expenditure money spent in his own campaign.
But if I could ask Tom, how many independent expenditures or issue ads are made in districts right now? I mean, only 10% or less of the districts are competitive, and that's only the only place where you have the independent expenditures.
Right.
So 90% of the races, there are no independent expenditures, no issue ads, and Tom would say we should have unlimited contributions to those 90% of the districts that are non-competitive, where the money would be government access money.
Only to the extent that you believe that you can buy Bill Leonard's vote.
Well,
and you're not.
No, I don't believe that.
And at some point, we'll let Bill Leonard speak for himself.
Exactly. Yeah. And who's setting the price?
Right.
For that, are we saying that, well, for $21,200 you can buy Bill Leonard's vote, but for $21,000 you can't, or for $22,000 you can't? I mean, why? That's what the point of campaign finance is supposed to be: is to prevent corruption.
Let's ask
provide equal access.
Let's ask the one person who's been a candidate up here, too, from this perspective.
Since my campaign
apparently they're
for governor
all...
is just folded.
I fundamentally disagree with Mr. Stern on the candidate's motivation for contributions. I don't know why people give me money. I as a candidate, am very clear about where my positions are, and I hope everybody in the audience that agrees with me would be willing to reach into their wallet and support someone that would vote the way that they already agree. That's what politics are about. That's the democracy in action. To put the dirty spin on it just corrupts the whole process in itself. I would argue full disclosure instantly. I think we all agree on that. But I would also support and advocate that lifting the limits and putting it back that I can raise money from people that support what I believe in and put the word out on that. I would further make the argument that despite the numbers you read that sound big, and I just was looking, the Federal Elections Commission just announced 2008 will be the first $1 billion presidential campaign. It's not enough. Campaigns are underfunded. I finally found an article I've been looking for a long time, and maybe you guys know better. Advertising Age had a story in early 2006 that in 2005, Pepsi spent $1.5 billion on advertising in 2005, and Coca-Cola spent $900 million. Now, I don't know if those numbers are accurate or not, but if they were even close to the ballpark, that's the two of the soft drink folks spent double what all the presidential candidates are going to spend a year from now. They already spent it a year ago. There's not enough information out there for voters to really understand and choose between candidates. One of the reasons there are such safe districts is the incumbents can count on the fact that their opponent has no ability to raise money to get content out about their message, to criticize their opponent's bad voting record, and to let the voters make an informed choice on that. So if your point is there's too much money in the system, then you want limits to squeeze it out, which I would further argue don't work because they will squeeze out somewhere else. Your analogy of water going through cracks is just perfect because that's what happens. I would rather have it up front, no limits. Everybody in the audience knows who gave to me instantly, and if it was their contribution, thank you. If it was not, then you know, and you can make your judgment on how to vote. I think there's not enough information out there, and what we're leading towards is a system of multimillionaires. The three candidates for governor in the two major political parties in 2006 were multimillionaires. And I think in 2010, it's going to be the same thing. You've got to be able to self-finance, to write your own check, to even, you know, get up to the starting line to start a race on that. And if you're not, no matter how big your base is, no matter how important your message is, no matter, you know, unless you're, you know, have some substitute for the dollars, like, you know, Hollywood superstar, and I know we've tried that, but unless there's some substitute for the dollars to get your name and message out, that's the kind of candidates we're going to see for statewide office in California forever because of the laws we have today.
Well, and it's funny, you mentioned self-finance candidates. It was on a list of ones that I was going to talk about. We certainly have had some examples. We seem to have more examples. We had a Democratic...
I'm not. That's why I need Bob's contribution.
We had a Democratic candidate for governor this year who was largely self-financed and was unsuccessful in his primary, and the current incumbent governor has put some of his own money, but clearly not to that same extent.
Close.
Mr. Hiltak could tell us probably how much exactly, but suffice
exactly.
That would be the reporter in me wanting to know that story. But suffice it to say, is there a way to make this system fair and equitable when you have people who can self-finance to that point? I mean, where do we find a solution process there, if any? I know Bill Leonard, my question is, why is that a goal?
Why is that a goal of campaign finance reform, to make the system fair and equitable and equal access? If the goal is supposed to be to prevent corruption. I mean, that's the only goal that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever recognized for campaign finance. And I think that's been part of the problem with the reform community is that their goal has been to sort of provide equal access and level the playing field. And that's not an appropriate role for campaign finance.
Well, that's according to the Supreme Court, it's not. Tom is right. You cannot prevent millionaires from financing their own campaign. Should we? If I were on the Supreme Court, I would say that millionaires corrupt the system. They corrupt the system because they make Bill Leonard go out and raise more money to run his race or to spend
more time fundraising.
Yeah, exactly. So I would argue the Supreme Court is wrong, but the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court, and you can't do anything about it. But in terms of why do people give Bill money? I mean, I did a study a few years ago of the California Medical Association. They gave to every single incumbent but one a campaign contribution of $500 or more. Every single – the most liberal Tom Hayden on the left, the most conservative on the right. And so I called them up. I said, why did you give to every single incumbent but one a campaign contribution? And they said, well, we have a question for you. And I said, what's your question? Who didn't we give to? Because we better give to that person. So I told them. They said, okay. So I said, answer my question.
You probably left me out.
No, it wasn't you. No. Why did you give to every single one? They said three words. Losers don't legislate. They're giving to incumbents because incumbents are there working on their issues. Business people and labor people don't waste money. I mean, if you're a business and your corporations can give in California, you can't waste your corporate money. They give for business purposes. They give because they're getting something in return, not a quid pro quo because that's bribery. But they clearly expect that they're getting something in return or they wouldn't be giving the money.
Let me ask this using the model that we're looking for, ways to move toward that bipartisan consensus toward solutions. Given that everyone seems to agree to the need for disclosure, and of course beyond that is where we start to get into our own different camps, but how do we provide for greater full disclosure? I mean, what are the common ground things that we could do now, and then look forward beyond that? And Leanne Randolph, I mean, from your vantage point with the FPPC, what could we do? You mentioned some of them in your opening statement, but what's a realistic time frame for the disclosure issue? Trying to may say get that off the table and move towards other issues.
Well, I think improving the SOS system. The online system is an immediate priority.
Secretary of State.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Secretary of State is an immediate priority. And it's sort of been kind of backburnered at the Secretary of State's office over the years. And it's time to bring it to the forefront and put together a system where we can integrate campaigns actually inputting their data and the system producing reports, providing information, as I mentioned, sort of reviving the notion of analysis. We talk about, well, it would be nice to have an independent group do some analysis. Well, you know, we have the FPPC. They used to do analysis. We need to reinstitute that, provide a system whereby a voter can look at their ballot pamphlet, get the link, go to the link, and get updated information about what the top five contributors are or whatever information they need to make their decision. And all the tools are there. It's just we just need the will to pull them all together and the funding to pull them all together. It's eminently doable. I also think integrating a state system with a local system would be great. Having the ability for a voter to go to one place and look and see what who's giving to candidates running at the state level and also who's giving to their local candidates would be a way to provide much greater access to the system.
So the other three, the three gentlemen who are on the panel, what do any of you sense as the impediment to making these things happen that that Leanne Randolph is talking about? I mean, is it just that it's been overlooked because people are doing something else? Is there real opposition to some of the things she's talking about, or any thoughts?
Well, I along with Kim Alexander, we're working on a project on disclosure throughout the states. And as I indicated, California is number one, and we're working with states that are not number one. South Dakota comes to mind. I think they're 48th. And I've been working with the South Dakota Secretary of State's office trying to get legislation through. And last year I testified before the Kansas legislature and testified before the state Senate. And one state senator said, you know, why do we have disclosure anyway? Why do we need disclosure? And she said she voted against the bill to improve the disclosure. And I walked out of the room and talked to a reporter and said, gee, I thought disclosure was settled 30 years ago. He said, this is Kansas. You have to remember evolution still is being debated here. So there are states that really don't want disclosure. And even in California, if you asked legislature to improve disclosure, if you wanted more disclosure, you have a tough time getting it through. Legislators, I mean, this is not just California. This is everywhere. I was in North Dakota talking to the Secretary of State. They don't have expenditure disclosure in North Dakota. They don't require any expenditure disclosure. And I said, why not to the Secretary of State? He said, we have a different mentality here. You know, we're a different state here. And besides, we don't want our opponents to know how we're spending the money before the election. I said, okay, how about after the election? He said, no, we're not even after the election. So there's a great reluctance on the part of elected officials to change the system that they're used to because, as Bill said, that's the system they've won under.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, isn't it possible that sometimes other proposals collapse under their own weight because they have so many moving parts?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've certainly seen that as a reporter. So I'm sorry, Bill Leonard, you were going to say?
The other factor is technical maturity. What we can do with the Internet now, we couldn't do last election cycle. Common bookkeeping systems where every candidate, kind of regardless of what form their bookkeeper uses, can now as reports in a common manner and can convert that to one, and it can go online electronically, and that every campaign, even down to the some local races, have an online presence. I think one of the things that come out of Voices Reform and their good work that, on the timing of this is technically the system is ready for that kind of leap forward. I think this. I mean, I remember the system where I was Republican leader in '98. The reporting analysis requirement was me sending volunteers to the Secretary of State's office and hand going through all the paper and photocopying the interesting pages. I mean, some others in the room have done the same thing.
Yeah, we used to do it as reporters.
Yeah, yeah. And reporters. I mean, the system. That's not that long ago. I think the system is now matured to the point that it's technically feasible. It's not an undue burden on candidates or other reporting disclosure mandates to do so, and it's one in which the system can handle if adequately funded. So I think the timing's right for that, and I think it should be pushed.
I think it's also important to note that and this was clear with former Secretary of State McPherson's task force, is you get everybody in the room who's invested in the current system, and it's hard to sort of toss it out and start from scratch in terms of forms and data and what kind of data gets reported and how it gets reported. That hasn't happened, and I think it's something that needs to happen.
One of the questions from the audience here talks about lessons that we might be able to learn from somewhere else. Paraphrasing, has any nation or state, maybe we'll stay with states for now, successfully curbed campaign contributions? And I'm wondering, you know, we do talk about models from other states. We've
Iraq,
looked at some of them.
Iran. No, I'm serious. Dictatorships have. If that's the question, deserves a serious answer. Free countries spend money to get the word out about their candidate, or if they're parliamentary countries, they do it about the ideology of their political party.
Yeah, but most countries publicly finance campaigns. I mean, the United States is, you know, we do it with presidential, and we do it with some states, but most countries fund the parties. So you don't have that problem. The Supreme Court, again, has ruled that you can't have really low contribution limits. There was a Vermont case recently decided. So one of the questions really is the Supreme Court First Amendment. But with public financing, you can get more restrictions on contributions and particularly on spending limits as well.
Bob,
but you don't affect independent expenditures in that context. You don't affect issue ads. You don't. You're not taking money out of the system. You're just redirecting it.
Well, you can affect it in the sense that you can match independent expenditures or issue ads, give more money to the candidates to counter those independent expenditure independent expenditures.
Let's continue on independent expenditures in a moment. But Bob, since I know you have looked at just out of curiosity from your vantage point, do you look at other states and anything that they have done so far on this issue of something we can take from here in California from them or not? And I know there's a mixed record on it, but what have you seen?
Well, certainly I think in Washington State leads the country in terms of online disclosures, and we can do a lot better in terms of our online disclosure. I hope the Secretary of State, she can probably do it on her own without legislation, and if she can spend some resources on it, it'll be a terrific boost to California. So Washington State clearly does better in terms of the online disclosures. In terms of public financing, Arizona and Maine do a terrific job in public financing. Those are states to take a look at as well. Connecticut is also just enacted public financing after a scandal. Arizona, by the way, funds its public financing program with a 10% tax on criminals. The criminals have to pay 10% more in fines, and that includes speeders and parking tickets. And the state is awash in criminal money, apparently, because the public financing program is returning money. In Connecticut, they have a very interesting solution. They take the surplus property that is unclaimed property and take them after 10 years when the property is sold, that goes into the public financing program. So there are a lot of other states out there that are doing very innovative programs that California should look to.
Well, let's go back, if I can, a moment to the question of independent expenditures that was coming up before I asked the question about other places to look at. We all know that independent expenditures are the big growing phenomenon and have been now for a while recently in California politics and campaigns. And I'm wondering what, if anything, we can do about the phenomenon, because as a reporter, I sometimes wonder, is this the effect of the campaign finance laws we've had, or would they exist anyway, even if we modified the system? Because donors and contributors and candidates and interest groups have all become so interested and familiar with them and like them. It seems to be the one place where people really don't know a lot about what's going on, their last-minute ads. You know, we can sit here and do the list of things. But does anybody have any thoughts on is this a system that part of the system that can be reined in some way, shape, or form? And maybe some of you don't think it should be, but anyone on the panel?
I hate independent expenditure committees as a candidate. I want to control my message and the fact that somebody who thinks they like me can put the word out in their content. I'm held accountable for it in a lot of ways by the press, but it's not my message. It's just the wrong way to go. Independent expenditure committees have been legal forever, but it wasn't until Prop 34 passed and put into place in which they started growing. It is an unintended consequence of limits on candidates, where I can only ask someone for so much money, they want to do more, and it goes from there. I mean, they know the rules, they know the game, and they go from there. The more sophisticated money groups know it better than others. And so until the limits are repealed, you're going to have independent expenditure committees driving elections more than, I mean, at some point, my prediction is all I'm going to be able to raise is bus fare. so I can go around the state giving speeches. The IE committees will buy all the TV ads, all the radio, all the newspaper, and they'll go do their thing with unlimited contributions, and it won't be my campaign. I'll just go around and do a whistle stop tour and give speeches, because that's all I can afford to raise.
And Leanne Randolph, if you could just bring it back into the current system. Independent expenditures operate, because as a result, they operate under a different system than candidate campaigns do. The public doesn't know what's happening in those committees as fast. Or as, I mean, it's a different reporting system, I think. As a reporter, I don't ever seem to know what's going on with those like I do candidates.
Well, we do have, we do have a fair amount of disclosure of independent expenditures. And the problem we run into is, as we discussed, there's no, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't allow us to limit them. They don't allow us to prohibit them. So what we are left with is providing disclosure of their expenditures and of their activity, to me, it goes back to the larger issue of whether or not having public financing might make more sense, or whether or not having ways to. One thing we've talked about is, well, the cost of campaigns are increasing, but can we bring those costs down through ways to access the airwaves and access additional means to reach the voters that are not paid for directly by the campaigns?
I think that's actually something that I consider campaign finance reform that's not frequently discussed. But, you know, examples of why is it that we have to have, our primary election in California has moved around, you know, bounced around from, you know, year after year after year. But even now at June, what's the magic behind having a primary in June and then letting all that time pass before we have a general election? A lot of states hold their primaries and their generals within, you know, 6-8 weeks of each other, where the money you spend in a primary to win has some carryover effect. So the cost of running a general election goes down significantly when it's only a 6-week or 8-week-long period. Why is that not discussed as campaign finance reform to reduce the costs? Other ideas like that. I mean, I think redistricting comes into play here too, and frankly, the size of our districts. God forbid that we talk about increasing the size of the legislature, but, you know, that's a potential too, where it wouldn't cost so much to run for an assembly seat if your district was smaller. Isn't that campaign finance reform?
Let me just say, I think it's far worse to have large contributions going to 100% of the incumbents than to have independent expenditures in 10% of the races.
One of the questions from our audience, I think, plays on part of the discussion that Bob Stern and Tom Hiltek were having earlier, or there was this theoretical contributions from tobacco companies and things like that. And it gets back to the disclosure issue, and it's an interesting way of looking at it. Would removing the limits and relying on disclosure obscure the motivation of some interest, but would it, long story short, would they still have the interest to obscure where their money was coming from? In other words, this is the example, I think this is the better way of saying it. Won't tobacco companies still use front groups to hide or disguise their involvement even without limits because they're non-popular, you know, socially and out there? You know, they look to be bad because they're tobacco companies. So even if you have full disclosure, they still may use a front committee. I mean, isn't that a – would we still have the same system somewhat, in other words?
Oh, I think you go back when we didn't have limits and tobacco companies made contributions. First of all, candidates could choose whether to accept them or not. They could make their own determination as to whether it was good or bad, and they would live or die by that decision. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, historically, you know, industries like that have not, you know, they've freely made contributions, and candidates have freely accepted or not accepted them. But if you take an independent expenditure environment where you don't have – you're a candidate, but you have no choice – you know, if the tobacco companies decide that you're their candidate, you may not want to be their candidate, and you may not want the voters to think you're their candidate, but you have no ability to control that.
Let me ask a topic we haven't talked about here that came up, that has come up in the last couple of years in the legislature. The governor talked about it when he ran in the recall campaign in 2003. Blackout dates for political contributions. Governor started, as I remember, as a reporter covering him, in one of his first political reform speeches, talking about a proposal to blackout fundraising during the budget season, which a lot of people say is a time there could be a lot of influence. That proposal went absolutely nowhere in the legislature. He sponsored a new one, didn't go anywhere again. But do blackouts work
for raising donations? Are they effective, or is there something there that we could look at? Perhaps, Leanne, you had a thought?
Well, I think blackout periods are problematic for several different reasons. I mean, you have First Amendment issues where you have, is the incumbent subject to the blackout period? What about the incumbent's opponent? Mm-hmm. What about statewide officials versus the legislature? And speaking as someone who has to deal with enforcing these laws, trying to enforce a blackout would be kind of a nightmarish scenario. So I, dealing with the, he said, she said of, yes, I said, I didn't raise any money, but so-and-so did say they were going to send me a check someday. And it just, I think it's very difficult. So I don't think that's a good answer to the problem.
Bob Stern, your
thoughts? Well, the LA Ethics Commission has had no problems with the blackout period. 2 years before running for citywide office, you can't raise money. 18 months before, you can raise money if you're a city council member. And they've had that in effect for about 15 years. I didn't like the governor's proposal because I thought, the budget is during an election year as well as a non-election year. And I think the candidate should be allowed to raise money in an election year, even during the budgetary process. I would be in favor of a blackout period in a non-election year, maybe up till September of the election year before. That would help challengers because the only persons who are raising money in non-election years generally are incumbents. They hold lots of fundraisers in Sacramento in non-election years. I remember one legislator holding a fundraiser saying, I want to have $500,000 at the end of this non-election year to scare away my opponents. And he succeeded on both accounts. He raised the $500,000 in the non-election year, and he scared away his opponents. So I think a blackout period in a non-election year, such as LA has, makes a lot of sense.
What about this non-election year idea? Bill Leonard, you've been in the legislature and certainly had a lot of campaign seasons to deal with.
It's not enforceable. The idea here is that candidate and their contributors are some kind of business transaction. It's people who agree with each other's agenda. You see your contributors all the time. At some event, because of the calendar, I don't accept checks, but we're all talking about my campaign budget, my need to raise money, the issues I want to run on, the kind of things I want to do when reelected and all that, so that as soon as the blackout period's lifted, my group's primed to write the check. I guess the challenger can do that too, but I'm not accepting money, but I'm doing everything but cashing the check. I mean, I'm priming the pump on that. It's an arbitrary date. In some of our large districts, you really need to start talking to candidates, and candidates need to start thinking about running 2 or 3 years ahead, building up their resume, getting out to know their communities. You talk Senate districts of 800,000-900,000 people. Odds are, unless you're the mayor of a 900,000-person city that accompanies that, no one's going to know your name in the rest of the district. Functionally, you need the time to meet everybody, which includes time to raise money to introduce yourself to people.
Well, let's ask, if I can, and this came up in one of the questions from the audience too, and I think this is a good point to put it in there. We've talked about clean money. We've talked about public financing of campaigns somewhere. We've talked about it, obviously, in the context of Proposition 89, which was defeated at the polls. This audience question says, do you think a pure clean money law without the limits on ballot measure committees, without some of the other language perhaps that was in the one that was sponsored on the November ballot, a pure clean money law could pass with the voters? And I think what we mean here is, could a clean public financing system be enacted? I mean, because some people would say, some analysts have said, perhaps it were the other elements of Prop 89 that really sank Prop 89, not the public financing. And I'm sure that's reading the tea leaves after the election, but could we do it if it was more simplified, if it was more streamlined, a proposal?
I think it's possible we could, yes. I think it depends on the cost. I think it depends on where the money comes from. Is it just taxpayers' money, or do you have a special fund that you can get it from? Again, I might be supporting in the near term some experiments to see that it does work in California.
Is it doable in California, given how expensive it is in California to run campaigns? I guess that's one of the questions. I know some of the other states smaller.
It's clearly doable in legislative campaigns. The statewide races are obviously much more expensive. But on the other hand, the voters would prefer to have it, I think, in the statewide campaigns over the legislative campaigns. But we had a Prop 68 in 1988 that we helped draft It was for legislative campaigns. It actually passed. The public approved it by 53%, but there was another proposition on the ballot that got more votes. So I think that if you want to keep the cost down, you deal with just the legislative campaigns. If you want to affect all the races, obviously you have to deal with statewide.
I guess I'd turn this back around on Bob and say if it's only 10% of the legislative seats are competitive, and I think the number is even less than that, why are we funding 100% of those races?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because legislators are still raising campaign money from special interests because they're worried about people running against them. They have this big fear, I think, that somebody's going to run against them. If they knew they could get public financing, I think they wouldn't raise the money from the special interests. And I think many of them, even in the non-competitive races, who still worry, they still worry about a millionaire coming in or somebody running against them, would be able to count on the public financing.
But 90% of the taxpayer funds would be wasted in campaigns,
no,
so the money
think,
doesn't need to be spent.
See, I don't think they would be wasted at all because I think to have the legislators not raising money from the special interests would be a tremendous benefit to California.
I guess that's I worry about the millionaire running against me, so I count me in that. I can't write the check, but I just don't see how the government could write me a check to match that millionaire's contribution to himself or herself in a timely and even if they could in an unlimited number. One of your questions is it capped or unlimited, and then in enough time that I could actually put together a campaign program and spend the public's money wisely. I guess if I could get past those, yeah, because I could stop. I think I could beat a millionaire on the issues. I'm confident of my campaign skills and willing to allow the voters to judge whether my issues are right or not. But I think I'd be relying falsely on the public being there through this program in a timely manner with an unlimited amount to match.
It's worked well in Los Angeles. We've had millionaires run and win, but their opponents getting public financing and running very competitive races and getting their message out. The question is, will you have enough money to get your message out? Not will you have enough money to match the millionaire, because you probably won't be able to match the millionaire, even raising money privately.
Well, California politics is littered with millionaires who ran and didn't win.
Yeah, but the independent expenditure is a problem there too, where in most campaign or public financing schemes, there's a matching program that tries to dissuade that. But as we know, independent expenditures happen like a day before the election, 2 days before the election. So when you go
not
up
– Not anymore, they don't.
When you go apply – but it would be.
Well,
I mean – but
over 45% of the people now vote by mail. Right. So it's going to be much earlier than that they're making the independent expenditures.
But if the IE comes in, you know, on the day before the election and you go apply to the FPPC for your matching funds and by the time they process your check, it's too late. It's over.
Here's a question from the audience that there's a budding campaign finance reform expert out there apparently because I've never heard of – who knows? This might work. Let's see what you guys think. What about reduced postage, tax breaks for candidates who challenge incumbents, free airtime and free ballot statements to help reduce campaign costs? Would methods like these be more popular with the public than public financing?
Yes.
I think those things have been talked about a little bit at the federal level. The problem is, of course, you're talking about the United States Postal Service and you're talking about the FCC. The FCC does actually offer lowest unit rate charges to candidates running airtime. They pay less than Pepsi and Coke pays. Federal candidates, correct. Yeah. But what typically happens is that because you're paying the least amount, the TV stations give preference to their highest paying customers, particularly the ballot measures, which pay top dollar for their ads. So ends up candidates sometimes actually pay full freight just to make sure their ad gets run during Desperate Housewives and the like because they don't want it run at night.
I think it's a terrific idea. The FCC several years ago said we're going to consider giving free time to candidates. Congress sent a letter saying if you even consider this, we're cutting your budget. Congress got furious because Congress said we don't want our opponents getting free time. And the TV stations, of course, the broadcasting industry is very powerful in Washington, D.C.
And if you take a look at American Idol last night, a lot of people like to be on TV, even when they're not very talented. Well, and I think there would be a lot of applications for free airtime.
It's interesting that a lot of the discussion we're talking about here does get back to one of the real cost drivers, at least from a statewide campaign perspective in California, which is television. Television
Absolutely.
Ads. We all know that's what so many statewide campaigns, ballot measures, and candidates are built around. Is there any way to get at that without, as you said, incurring the wrath of broadcasters or candidates or others?
Well, there's another.
And I say it completely as a public radio person, where we don't have.
the FCC used to have something called the Fairness Doctrine, where for every four ads that were run in a ballot measure campaign, the other side got one free ad. They repealed that in 1992. I think it was one of the reasons that Prop 103 passed in 1988 was they got free TV ads from the TV stations. But remember, technology, the internet. I mean, for people who want to get information about campaigns and ballot measures, I think you can get plenty of information for free right now. I think anybody who really wants the information can get it. The problem, of course, is that most TV commercials, and Tom, you know this better than I do, are directed to people who don't want to get the information, who are not that interested in the campaigns, and who are interrupted during American Idol, and who don't have TiVo to run through the ad. And so most of the TV ads are spent for people who are not that interested in politics. I may be one of the few people in the state that uses my TiVo to look for political ads, as opposed to skipping.
You are the only.
Sorry.
There's a few of us. It does seem to be one of the most vexing parts of it, though, and trying to get everyone on board from that. From a candidate's perspective, Bill Leonard, is there any way? I mean, do candidates have anything? Well, let's put it this way, actually. How could you convince an incumbent candidate who is a legislator to go along with something that would grant some kind of airtime to opponents and whatever? Is there any way to appeal to their better angels?
Well, I know that I've heard the story of Bob Stern talked about with Congress, but I think Canada's perspective, I think I can spend my campaign dollars more effectively than my opponent. So the idea that both of us had access to discounted rates for television or radio or newspaper or mail, doesn't bother me at all. It would reduce my – I could campaign – more with the same amount of money, and I'd try to have a fundraising advantage to the extent that I could anyway, but I'd also think I'd be more effective. I mean, that's my great insurance against the multimillionaire candidates, and most of them are too stupid and hire too many consultants and never get enough money out there to the media, so they don't spend their money wisely. So that doesn't bother me as much as I hear to bother friends in Congress on that.
As we're coming here toward the latter half of our program, I want to come back to this issue of building on what you can agree on and how you go from there. And while they have a lot of ideas out here, disclosure is something we've all talked about that everyone seems to agree on in a certain way. And I'm wondering, I asked this in one way, but let me rephrase the question this time, and I'd like to go through the panel if I could. Putting on whatever hat you'd like to wear, how could we start that process tomorrow? How could we start? What could we do to get a bill in the legislature? You may have to move it by ballot initiative, of course. Who knows? But what could you do starting tomorrow to resolve some of the issues of disclosure that everyone can seem to agree on before you moved on? I mean, what are some real substantive steps, I guess? And the panel is silent.
I don't think there are any.
Really?
I'm really confident that our new Secretary of State is going to be doing that in this next election cycle. And if she needs money or she needs some sort of legislative permission, then aggressively go for it. I think the next question is to her, because I think it's mature and it's out there now. One thing I was thinking of, though, that I would add to it, I accepted spending limits in this cycle under Prop 34, even though I voted against it as many times as I could. Because the benefit of having the Secretary of State mail out a 500-word or 250-word statement on my behalf to every one of the voters in my district, which I can't afford, was affordable. It was worth accepting the limit to do that. I turned the table. I could only get that benefit if I agreed to the limits. I would say to every candidate, you file for candidacy, you must file a statement. And that must be printed and sent out to every voter, and hopefully including your web page address and what your issues are, so every voter has a ballot pamphlet. Because you're right, we got the disinterested voter and we got the really active voter, but every voter eventually gets to the ballot pamphlet, and if they don't see anything about the candidate, they're lost. They're going, you know, the billboard kind of thing, to ever hear the name before. But if there's a ballot statement there, I'd make it more mandatory than this kind of incentive that it is now. And I don't know about you, but on some local races where I've never heard of who's running for who, the fact that they bought a ballot statement or took the time to ask me for my vote in that makes all the difference in the world. I don't even look at the candidates who didn't file a ballot statement. I'd make that mandatory and encourage them to have a website that if I want to know more, I can go and email them and listen to what they're doing on the website.
But just to make it clear, as I understand, to reframe, you don't believe we need statutory, constitutional changes, any kind of legislation to deal with the disclosure, the way to get there, you think it can be done basically administratively by the Secretary of State?
Not for candidates. I'm with you. I'm not quite as sure on IEs. I mean, I stayed up midnight several times in the election cycle on the Secretary of State's website trying to find out IEs, and I don't know what their reporting requirements are. For candidates, I think it's just making it a more user-friendly system, pushing candidates, and it may require statute for that to make it instant reporting. That would be the big reform that might come out of this.
Bob Stern, what could we do?
Well, I have three things in terms of disclosure, and then, of course, many other things in terms of campaign financing. Let me just talk about the disclosure. Brian Joseph of the Orange County Register did a terrific story about lobbyists and others showing up at fundraisers, not giving a check, but eating all the food and then saying, I'll pay you later. And the FPPC ruled that that was not considered a contribution or a pledge because they hadn't given any money. I would say that is a pledge that is enforceable and would require disclosure. If somebody comes to a fundraiser and signs something saying that they're going to make a contribution, that should be reported before the election. And I hope everybody would agree on that. Two, I think the inauguration expenses need to be itemized better, more disclosure in terms of the contributions coming into inauguration expenses and how the money is spent. And then three, and Tom will disagree with me on this one, but a lot of local communities come to me and say that we can't get good disclosure laws at the local level because we have state committees coming in making independent expenditures or other expenditures, and the state laws don't allow us to require disclosure before the election. So I would allow the local authorities to impose additional disclosure laws on state committees that come in and get involved in local elections. So those are my three disclosure proposals. I'm not too optimistic that any of the three would pass, but I'll put them out there.
I guess this is fun. I think Leanne made this point. I think the Secretary of State's office and the FPPC and kind of following from the McPherson Commission kind of needs to sit down and scrub their mind of everything they know about the timetables upon which we file reports and what the forms look like and the audit procedures and take a look at technology and say, okay, now if we were going to build a disclosure system now, today, what would we build? And I tell you what, it would look a lot different than what we have now. Take just typical banking, for example. Do I still have to keep copies, paper copies of checks? Nobody else in the business community. I mean, most people actually, they scan deposits at their desk. You don't even go to the bank anymore. And so technology has moved so much in the last few years that I think we actually need to scrap what we built over the last 25 years and say, okay, what would we do now if we were starting over? And I think that's the place to start.
I think the key is having a decent programmer at the Secretary of State's office. I mean, you know, sitting down with the best programming minds and taking a look at systems like LA's system and looking at how we can make that expand it and make it so that the interface between the filers and the system is seamless so that then the voter can access that same information that the campaign is entering in as it's, you know, not as it's happening, but, you know, in a relatively short period.
And let's not be afraid of logic. I mean, for example, the timetable, the deadlines for filing campaign reports makes no sense to anyone on the face of the earth. Depending on what type of committee you are, maybe you file every 10 days, maybe you file every 90 days, maybe you file quarterly, maybe you file semiannually, maybe you file 16 days before the election, or maybe you file 45 days before the election, or God knows you try to figure out which one it is.
That's what I pay you for.
Exactly. And why can't we do something like maybe everybody files every month? Maybe everybody files every week.
Because those are for the most part statutory, and when people were sitting down and taking a look at them, there was a lot of pushback to the notion of, well, but this is the system we have, this is what we're used to, this is what the candidates know, And, you know, we like having this report at this timetable, and we like having this report at this timetable. And it's hard to get people to think differently.
And when the political attorneys and political accountants were asked, why can't we just file every 2 or 3 days? They said, oh, no, we can't do that. That would be too much work. I mean, you know, I mean, Bill talks about instant filing, but when you talk to the lawyers and accountants, there's no way that they're going to support something filing continuously. So
that's because we like to have weekends off once in a while.
So as we're approaching the end here, let me just and we may not even go through the whole panel, but I would just like to try to close it on this. If we were sitting here this time in 2008, I'm wondering, does anyone see what might have changed, what could change, what's on the horizon this year that we should be looking out for on the issue of the issues of campaign finance and campaign finance reform? And some of you may say not much, but any thoughts that would be realistic to look at, Bob Stern, perhaps?
Well, I might say 2010 or 2012, because I think technology is going to overtake a lot of this. I think that I agree with Tom. We should be really looking at these things in terms of more disclosure. See, I would go for more disclosure, and a lot of people go for less disclosure. But I think that technology will enable us to get access to these disclosure statements much quicker. And hopefully let the voters get much more information.
Anyone else, real quickly?
January 31st is the next deadline for filing. It's for the December 31st period. It will be the 2006 report. Once that's out there and we do the analysis compared to 2002, last statewide election, we'll know a lot more in the next 18 months about the growth of IEs, about the ability to disclose, and about the number of self-finance candidates comparing a pre-Prop 34 election 2002 to the first statewide one under Prop 34. And I think that information post-January 31st will be valuable and help implement the next cycle.
Well, certainly we have some consensus here on the issues of disclosure, it seems like. I will be curious to see if that happens. Let me thank our panelists for their contributions to this afternoon's discussion. They are, again, Leanne Randolph, Commission Chair, Fair Political Practices Commission, the Honorable Bill Leonard, former Republican leader of the State Assembly and a member of the Board of Equalization, Tom Hiltak, partner of the law firm Bell, McAndrews & Hiltak, and, of course, Bob Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies. We also, of course, thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.